Monday, 15th of September, 2025. So I was sitting before the talk. I was thinking, who's going to request the talk tonight? I wonder who. Oh, it's Anagarga Theo. I'm feeling quite good right now. Good about the community and about what's happening here. And we had the Buddhist bicycle pilgrimage come in yesterday. So a big event. And they were very grateful to be able to come here. And I think also I feel grateful to be able to host people like that. It was 40% of them were new people, so they'd never been to the monastery before. So just to have that opportunity to people who are, they joined what, a Buddhist bike ride, sounds good, sounds kind of spiritual, but no idea what we're doing here in the monastery in terms of the precepts we're following and the lifestyle that we're living here. So it was a lot of them, it was a new learning experience. So when we step back and look at what we're doing here, it is really inspiring. It's very inspiring for people to see us come here and practice and follow virtue, not just the monastics, but the lay people as well. Just to see that there's people living here in a way that is very peaceful and virtuous. That's very, very good. It was like these two ladies from Willits showed up and Linda was talking to them just about what we do here, because they're like, oh, you guys hid this place really well. We've been living in Willits all our life. We never even knew about this place. And this is a really good find, hidden treasure of Mendocino County. And they were kind of curious about what things are happening. Linda's getting them a tour. Oh yeah, the monks have to receive food into their hands and they don't use money. And they're like, really? Whoa, what? Really? Oh, wow. So too, sometimes it's nice to step back and see it through the eyes of someone who's totally unfamiliar with this place. And then you realize how good it actually is. So, and I remember when my parents first visited me here when I was in Anagarika. I'd been in Anagarika for 6 months, and I had already become the water monk at that time. And actually, Scott, who was Tan Obaso here in the early days, Scott, who was on the bike ride, he was reminding me of some of the memories from that time. And he was actually there the day I became the water monk. So I was a usually we wait till somebody's a novice to make them the water monk, but I was a water monk in Anagarika. And so there was a mystery leak in the water line, which all water monks will know is a common occurrence, or at least not uncommon. And so we were up on the road, kind of above the workshop area, and it was all dirt road at that time. Of course, in 2022, we paved our roads, so things are always changing. For a very long time, we had a rough dirt road, and we knew the water leak was between point A, point B somewhere, maybe at this one place. So I was very intent to help out as much as I could and dig trenches and get in really good shape and use up some of that excess energy. And yeah, Scott was there with me. I think he had probably just become a novice, so he was just newly Obaso. And I was still in Anagarika, and I took the pick, and I swung as hard as I could into the road. And the pick went into the ground, and then geyser of water. I found the water line. And now we probably have a new water break. Or we definitely have a new water break. This geyser of water. So then I knew I would be the water monk. And I had forgotten about that. He was reminding me of that story. But then I mentioned my parents coming, so that was a bit of a lead up to my parents coming, because then I was learning all about the water system, and it was December, so I arrived here in late June 2021, and I became an Anagarika in August, and then it was December that my parents were, so yeah, I'd been in Anagarika about 4 months actually, and it was snowing. And for those of you who might remember the old house, we had, at that time, we had one bathroom and shower for the entire male monastic community. And so it was snowing, and I was waiting for my parents, and they were going to arrive sometime in the afternoon. And then I hear this water, sound of a waterfall, which is not a good sign, and went out behind the monk's bowl washing area, and a big 2-inch pipe had come apart and there was just water just pouring out. So I slipped my sandals on and I was running up to these water tanks in the snow in my sandals, and my feet were getting very cold. And I kind of then got to the hill where the above where the water tanks are, and I was kind of sliding down the hill to turn them off so we wouldn't run out of water. And I turned the water off and could put on some sort of divert. I was going to go back down. There's a way to divert the water so that we would still have water. But when I got down, my feet were getting numb from the cold. And so I went to the one bathroom shower and I slipped my sandals off and started running warm water over my feet in the bathtub. And then that's when my parents showed up. So when they showed up for their first visit to Ubayagiri, I was standing in the bathtub to greet them. Warming up my near frostbitten feet. But they were like, one of the first things they said was, "How did you find this place? This is amazing." I guess it's just a lot of interesting circumstances coming together, comma. So yeah, just stepping back and seeing what we have here is very interesting, and all the developments that have happened. I was also recollecting a lot of the things that have happened in the past year, because we just completed this calendar, 2026 calendar. You know, Lompa Munindo, who used to do our calendars, has retired, which he's done it for so long, and he's done so many calendars for the entire Forest Sangha. So a lot of the monasteries are kind of wondering what they're going to do for their calendars. I thought, well, next year is our 30th anniversary, might as well do a 30th anniversary calendar. So I'm quite happy with how it turned out, but then looking at the photos on it, just recollecting over the years, and January photo is from the first week of Ubayagiri, and it's Ajahn Amaro standing on the porch of the house looking at the garage, which is the dining hall, but it was just a garage still. They hadn't done anything with it yet. And there's a quote also from Ajahn Amaro. He was recollecting that time at Ubayagiri, and he said, "That first day when we arrived and got everything kind of cleaned up and we got sorted and settled and put our things down, and it's like, okay, the monastery is done. We're here. The monastery is complete. We've done everything we need to do." So I think that's a really great attitude to have. We just cultivate that attitude each and every day. Also, Longpo Buddhadasa, he would say he was building a huge ordination hall, an Opposita hall, one time at his monastery, and very big project. And then somebody asked him, "When is it finished? When is it going to be finished?" And he said, "Well, I pick it up in the morning and I do what I can in one day, and then at night it's finished. It's just, I consider it completed at night. It's finished because, you know, there doesn't have to be a burden on the mind. We can drop it." Or I found this little Buddha shrine house project. There's a lot more to do on it, but for now it's finished. It's good enough. We can leave it for a time being and then can add something more to it later on. Yeah, it's not in its final, what its final incarnation is probably going to be, but for now it's finished. Don't have to think about it too much. So of course, yes, once Ajahn Amaro and the Anagarika, who was to become Ajahn Kurudamo, showed up on that first day, then yeah, that sense of just settling in and it's finished. But then of course there was a massive amount of work, a monumental amount of work that ensued after that. And so now 29 years in, it's pretty amazing to just think back. And I got here in year 5. So 2001 was year 5. And it was still very basic. There was still a lot of trailers. They, instead of kutis, the first year they brought in trailers, and they called it, people were calling it RV Hara. And then eventually 5 kutis got built, but they were very basic. And then after those kutis got built, they found out about this thing called building codes. Well, what, you can't just build something? Like in Thailand, you can't just put up a kuti wherever you want? So they got flagged on that. But then those kutis got grandfathered in, and we had to promise to eventually replace them with proper legal structures. So it was, yes, 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 they're just temporary. They're just kind of plywood huts just to get out of the weather temporarily. 25 years later, we replaced the Black Rock Cooties, new ones. And then it didn't really matter because actually everybody who had originally told us that about the original Cooties had all retired. So all the new people in the building department have an idea now of what we're doing, but oh, you want to build it? Oh, what? There's an old play. What? What's going on? It's so long ago. So I'm very grateful also just to be able to be a part of the Lungpa Cha Sangha and having Lungpa Liam here earlier this year and Lungpa Kun, Lungpa Dumrong, and just being able to be a part of what's happening in the world in terms of these great beings that we know. And I remember what drew me to Lungpa Cha was there was something different about his teachings. So I hadn't yet read suttas. I had read some Tibetan teachings, and I'd listened to talks by the Dalai Lama, by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And I was taken by those teachings, and I was inspired by them. And also, you know, reading books like Krishnamurti, I was dabbling in Hinduism a little bit. But then when I picked up Ajahn Chah, there was something different about it. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. And there was a certain energy to it. And there's a certain feeling I got that I didn't get with anything else. And I still get that feeling when I listen to a Dhamma talk, say by Lungpa Liam, or any of the great Ajahns. I remember turning on, just a couple days ago, I turned on a Lungpa Tui talk. He's one of the disciples of Lungda Mahabua, and got that same energy, got that same feeling. So I think of it as the Aryan energy and the energy of the noble ones. You could say the vibration, the vibe of the noble ones. And it's really different than anything else. And there's an automatic settling that happens in the mind when we come into contact with it. And that's very, very special. And then eventually getting the opportunity to go to India and Bodh Gaya, and it was there too. It was at Bodh Gaya, and it was at Wat Pa Pong as well. That same feeling. So it's really from the Buddha. It's the Barami. It's the feeling of Barami, the Buddha's Barami, the Barami of the Savaka Sangha, the liberated students of the Buddha, disciples of the Buddha. I get that same feeling. And sometimes it's kind of that feeling is off to the side, and sometimes it's very prominent, very strong, and really, really powerful and moving. And it's kind of like we, you know, none of us here have met Ajahn Mun, not in this lifetime anyway. But still, you get that, you see an image of Ajahn Mun, you get that same feeling. And I remember being in this, my third year away where I was in Wat Pa Nanacha for the Vasa. And in December, I got to see Ajahn Pasano because he would visit Thailand. He still visits Thailand every year. And so he visited and met up with him, was his Upatak attending to him. And I think Ajahn Amaro came as well. And so we went to this, we were given a tour of this new park in Bangkok called Kruba Park. And there was a lot of traditional style kutis like in the old forest monasteries. And each kuti had wax figures of these different Kruba Ajahns, of great Kruba Ajahns from the past. And so you'd go into one kuti and it'd be like Ajahn Sao and Ajahn Wan or something like, and then like another kuti would have like Ajahn Kao and like Ajahn Fun or another Ajahn. There was a lot of Ajahns in these different kutis, wax figures, very extremely lifelike. Extremely lifelike wax figures. So it looked like you were really meeting these Ajahns. But because we were in a park or in a lay person's area, we weren't considering ourselves to be in a monastery. We had our robes over both shoulders. And one of our rules or our standards of training is that we don't bow when we have our robe over both shoulders. We just do Anjali if we want to pay respects. If we're bowing, we usually put our robe over just one shoulder and have this shoulder exposed. and we were going into each kuti and just paying respects like this to each Kurbajan. And then when Longpo Pisano and myself walked into the kuti of Ajahn Mun, we both just like dropped to the ground and started bowing automatically. We didn't even look at each other. We both did the same thing. We both just started bowing. It's so powerful, that image of Ajahn Mun. So there's something about, it's like a Kruba Ajahn among Kruba Ajahns, Ajahn Mun, something very, very special about him. And of course, he ended up being the greatest influence on Ajahn Chah's life, according to Ajahn Chah, even though he only spent 3 days with him. So this is something worth taking note of when we come into contact with that feeling. It's not just coming from nowhere, and it's not just us. There is something to it, and it's good to make much of it. And when we lose the plot, which inevitably happens often, then we can recollect, this is Sangha Nusati, so we can recollect these ajahns, and we can tap back into that, because that's what we're really here for. And then how do we come into contact with that more and more? Sila Samadhi Panya, it's the path of practice. And however much we're able to let go of in the mind, however much we're able to express our sense of dedication to the practice through dana, through cultivating patient endurance, through the cultivation of equanimity and sitting walking meditation, and cultivation of mindfulness in every posture, that's really what we call patipati puja. It's honoring the Buddha and the Sangha in the best way we can. So making a practice or our life of practice into an offering. So meditation can be seen as generosity. Meditation is a type of dana when we do it, when we really get over whatever barriers we have to actually doing the meditation, doing the sitting meditation, doing the walk meditation. And it's, the mind is not in ideal condition, so there's going to be inevitable difficulties. Some rare people might just settle every time into meditation, but most of us, it's a struggle, and then once in a while, it feels peaceful. So, but it's, if we actually put in the time and do the work, then we're going to go through all of the karma, we're going to resolve all of the accounts, it's all going to come up. And I do believe this is what Ajahn Chah means when he says, you have to die before you die. If you really want to practice, you have to die before you die. And that doesn't mean physical death, and it doesn't even necessarily mean ego death. I'm not sure I even like that term, ego death. I'm not sure it doesn't really point to the truth of not self that the Buddha's talking about. Die before you die is like, if you think of when you hear about people who have near-death experiences, their whole life is relived, their whole life flashes before their mind's eye. So something similar happens with meditation, with long-term meditation, but in a much slower process, that all the memories come up, all the things we've done that we might regret, all the things we felt good about. You're doing hours and hours of walking meditation, that's all going to come up. And we allow it to come up. We're metabolizing everything that's happened in our lives and settling the accounts. And then when we settle the accounts and we are able to lay aside all those conditions, then we can be at ease. So that's the whole reason for having virtue and studying the Dhamma and putting into practice all the practices that the Buddha recommended in the suttas, and putting into practice all the practices recommended by the Kruba Ajahns. Then we can finally settle the accounts, finally be at ease, and things might start to cool down a little bit more. Things won't be as heavy. Things won't be as heavy as they were before. The heart will be light, and mind will be bright. Maybe we won't take ourselves as seriously as we did before. Nah. I remember when I was in Anagarika, I used to argue with Ajahn Amaro sometimes. I could never imagine doing that now. I just didn't know. I didn't know. I didn't know that was not to be done. I just thought, no, that's not what you said, Ajahn. Yes, it is. No, it's not. You didn't say that. Yes, I did. You know, getting into these strange arguments with Ajahn Amaro. Now, you're like, okay, I would back down really quickly now. But just over time, we learn. I remember going to Thailand and thinking, Oh my God, I can't believe I said those things as an Anagarika. You know, seeing the respect they have for the Ajahns and how people move and show respect and friendliness for each other. Oh no, God. So when I came back from that first year in Thailand, I was very quiet. It's like, okay, I didn't know what was happening before. Sorry. But it's good. It's good. It's good to go through all those things. And the Ajahns were very patient with me. So I do try to be very patient with others now. We do have a genuinely very good community here. I think people here tend to be a little bit more refined than I was back then. When we come to the monastery, we also develop friendships that last for a very long time. So remember, Tan Achilo was the guest monk when I came here. And also, Scott, former Obaso, was reminding me that, he was the first one I met when I arrived. It was the afternoon, there was nobody. I mean, a very small, there was only like six people living here at the time. But he came out, he was in Anagarika already, and he said, I said, it's the guest monk here, and he said, Tan Achilo, there's a Viking here to see you. So that was then I remember first interaction. So Ajahn Achilo, as when he was four Vasas, he was the first monk I met in person. Then Tan Achilo, hello. So we're still friends. Although I also wasn't always so respectful or friendly to him. He was always trying to check in with me and kind of wanting to walk up the hill and like, is everything all right? Because I mean, I was 20 and thinking back, of course he wanted to check in with me. Like, are you settling in? Is everything all right? You know? And I told him, I didn't come here to make friends. All right. So, I said, I'm just here to practice. I'm not here to make friends. He's like, all right. Just got really embarrassed thinking about that. And it's fun to talk with him about it now. So he left. I was still in Anagarika when he went back to Thailand, but then meeting up again much later was always very good. It's like, sorry about that. It's good to have friends. Good to have friends in the holy life. And Debbie reminded me, she's like, as an Anagarika, I went up to her one day and I said, why is everyone touching me? Like patting me on the shoulder and kind of... I found out later that's a thing in Thailand, just kind of, you know, being friendly and kind of said, why is everybody touching me? This is weird. This is foreign to me. So yeah, the heart can change over time, and it is, things can soften over time. I think my time in Thailand really did teach me a lot about that. Oh yeah, it's about being peaceful. It's not about just getting all the precepts right. It's not about just doing everything perfectly or fitting yourself into the perfect box, but it's about it. We do try to keep the precepts as well as we can. And we do try to keep the kalwat, the standards in the monastery, but what is it for? We always have to remember, what is it for? And it's for really just deepening that sense of mindfulness and clear comprehension, sati sampajanya, coming into contact more with that energy of the Kripa Ajahns, that energy of the Buddha, the parami of the Buddha, getting us closer to, we would say, being able to really see the Buddha. And being able to see the Buddha doesn't mean we see what the Buddha looked like historically, but it means to see the knowing, to see the real Buddha. So to get us closer and closer to being able to see the Buddha, that's so important. So I think sometimes it's kind of fun to reminisce like this and to look at our own foibles and just say, just kind of laugh at ourselves and say, yeah, this is, these reflections can be helpful for helping us to have a sense of just being able to sustain the practice, being able to have a long enduring mind and being able to really just stick with it. You know, everybody slips up and we might lose the plot from time to time, but then to always come back into contact with why we're really here, what we're really doing here. So I think this evening I just got some acupuncture and it would be good for me to rest. So I'm just going to leave it as a short reflection this evening and I'll I'll offer just that.